Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight, Fixing the Game, What Capitalism Can Learn from Sports, with Roger Martin, the dean of the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto, and Doug Lemoyne, who is a managing director at Cooper here in San Francisco. So I would like to ask our speakers to come up to the stage right now. I'm very excited to have Roger Martin here from Toronto. Roger is the dean of a very cool design MBA program at the University of Toronto and writes regularly for the Washington Post and Financial Times. In the past, he did some very interesting work on design and business for Business Week magazine. Doug is a leading designer and managing director for Cooper, which is an interactive design firm here in San Francisco, but does work all over the world. And they both are sports freaks. So there is a very Roger's brand new book, Fixing the Game. It's not brand new, but it came out recently. And Doug and Roger share both a very insightful interest in management and design and sports fanaticism. So I'm really looking forward to hearing them talk tonight. About 6:40, we'll be turning it over to questions from the audience. So look forward to that. Thank you. Thank you.
So just to be clear, Roger's kind of in disguise tonight, but I'm Doug Lemoyne. I'm the designer. That's Roger. He's the dean. Mm-hmm. Let's start with Fixing the Game, since that's the title of the program. So what is the game, and why is it broken?
Well, it's two games, and the brokenness is the interaction between two games that should be severed. So if you think about it, in the world of business, the game that we would think about being played by companies is building real factories to produce real products or services, to sell them to real customers for real money and earn a real profit or loss at the end of the year. And that's all sort of real stuff. Associated with that is an expectations game, which is investors looking at the real game and what's going on and imagining what's going to go on in that real game in the future. And on the basis of that, making a form of bet. That is buying or selling shares of that company's stock, which are based on their expectations about what might happen in the future. Those two games, until the late 70s, in the wake of an important article that was written in 1976, were actually kept quite separate. And they were kept separate in a way two other games are kept separate, which are two games associated with sports, football. So as we all know, there's a real game in the NFL that's played every Sunday on real field for real 60 minutes, real passes, real throws, real touchdowns, real field goals, a real score with a real winner and a real loser. There's also an expectations game associated with that, which is called betting on NFL football, where bettors between Monday and Saturday imagine what's going to happen on Sunday and on the basis of that bet on one team or the other. And the Las Vegas bookies establish a point spread that is designed to put equal amounts of money on either side of the bet. In the NFL, they've come to a conclusion about the real game and the expectations game. And the conclusion is, if we let players in the real game also play in the expectations game, terrible things will happen to the real game. So we do not want quarterbacks betting on NFL football games, because they might then do things in the real game to make their bets come more true and benefit from those bets in the expectations game. That, in my view, is a appropriately played game or set of games. In business, after 1976, we decided, the world of business decided that not only could the quarterbacks, the CEOs, play in the expectations game, they must play in the expectations game. We'll give them tons and tons of stock-based compensation. We'll insist on them getting that. And what that's done is created a link between those two games that never existed, where the players in the real game have incentives based strongly on the expectations game. And since that has happened, we've had an increase in volatility, a decrease in returns to shareholders, two major, major meltdowns, one of which is still, ask anybody in Greece, still roiling its way through the economy. So the fix is that we've got to separate them, and what the business can learn from the NFL is the NFL's figured that out. It isn't that complicated, and we should take its sage advice on this issue.
Hmm. So in sports, if you play really well and your team wins and your fans love you, you get paid more. And a lot of times in your compensation, you have incentives to individually perform more. Mm-hmm. Why don't stock options or stock work the same way in a company? Like, the idea is that you become essentially a principal in the firm by getting that stock. So why doesn't it work in the same way in business as it does in sports?
Well, because those are two very different things you've talked about. If you play better in the real game as a quarterback, you'll make more money. What if we said to the quarterback, here's the deal. If you beat the point spread more often, we'll pay you more money.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That would be the moral equivalent to saying to a CEO, we'll give you stock options. You have to beat the point spread. So in the magical season that the New England Patriots had when they went 16-0, the first team to go 16, undefeated in a regular season, they were 16-0 in the real game. Tom Brady threw for 50 touchdown passes, the most in NFL history. Was the MVP of the season, but he only went 10-6 against the point spread. You say, how can that be? They were such a great team. They're 16-0. Shouldn't have they beaten the point spread 16 times? No. Why? Well, for the first 8 games of the season, they went 8-0 against the opposition and 8-0 against the point spread. They won by more than the point spread. And then what do you think happened to the point spread? It widened. It widened dramatically. So much so that, in fact, in the back half of the season, they faced the 3 highest regular season point spreads in the history of the NFL. Right? And they went 2-6 against the point spread, so that they went 10-6 overall against the point spread. Now, another team, the Cleveland Browns, that year did surprisingly well. They still missed the playoffs. People thought they were going to be terrible. They were only pretty bad. And so they went 12-4 against the point spread, quarterbacked by that well-known quarterback, Derek Anderson, a journeyman who's no longer in the league. If they would have instead been NFL executives, do you know who would have made more money that year? Derek Anderson, because he beat the point spread more often. That's what stock-based compensation is. It is the only way you can make your money on your stock-based compensation is if you beat expectations, not beat beat reality. Not have your company perform better, it's your company performs in excess of whatever the expectations happen to be. The tricky thing, of course, is that Tom Brady found out about expectations. Right? If you do great things, your expectations get so high that you can't beat them. And you can see there's a pattern of executives. Around 1980-81, we saw the first really big incidences of huge stock-based compensation packages. Actually, it was Robert Quazetta, the late CEO of Coca-Cola, took over in 1980, got a big stock-based compensation package. In 81, Jack Welch took over GE, got a big stock-based compensation package. For the first about 10 years, you can see what CEOs did not recognize the schism between these two markets, the real market and the expectations market. And so they worked feverishly to make their companies perform better in the real market because they believed they would get payoffs in the expectations market with their stock-based compensation. Then they all woke up somewhere between 1990 and 1995 and said, wait a minute, wait a minute, it's not working the way we thought. If we get expectations way sky high, then there's nothing we can do to get them higher, so the options grants we get at the start of that year are kind of worthless, and in fact, the stock is going to go back down. This sucks, I hate it. And they started playing a different game, which was manipulating expectations for as long as they could, get them sky high, and then get out. And, you know, the person who did it most masterfully was Jack Welch, who got out, guess when? Right when GE stock hit $447 billion in market cap, highest it's ever been, perhaps highest it'll ever be in the future. So that's the problem. The problem is we think that stock-based compensation, stock options, are an incentive to make the company's real operations perform well. They're not. They're an incentive to raise expectations from their current level. That can't be done over the long run. So what it is an incentive to create volatility. What you do is you try and jerk expectations up through going to Wall Street and hyping your stock, doing a bunch of really stupid mergers that make it appear that you're growing very quickly, or do something that's now quite popular, that wasn't popular before 1980, which is engage in massive accounting fraud. There was no massive accounting fraud before 1980. There wasn't. There now is just repeated waves of massive accounting fraud, and the best way to increase expectations is to have your earnings go up 20% in a given year because you've played with the books.
So, how do we unravel this mess?
It's not that complicated in terms of what we need to do. How to get that done is, so what we need to do is end stock-based compensation.
I was worried that you were going to say that, but
yeah.
Go on.
Yeah, just, I mean, it's if we think, so why do we think in the NFL it's such a bad idea? Right? We worry about things like point shaving and tanking and those things. Why would CEOs be any different than quarterbacks? So I would say that we're going to have this increased volatility, more market meltdowns, as long as we have stock-based compensation because CEOs have now figured that out. But I do other things like, you couldn't give guidance, right? Everybody gives guidance now. You couldn't give guidance without being sued before 1995. Then we had the Securities Act of 1995 that allowed you to say the most weaselly things imaginable at your annual meeting as long as you read this goofball safe harbor provision, right? It repeal it. Make guidance dangerous to give. All of those things would be helpful to the cause.
So you're also on the board of two major North American companies, Thomson Reuters and Research in Motion. Is there anything that people at that level can do to help unravel?
It's hard. One thing you can do is quit giving guidance, which we've stopped doing at one of those two companies. So there's some influence. But it is hard to not give stock-based compensation because stock-based compensation benefits nobody but CEOs, right, or people being given stock-based compensation. It's terrible for shareholders. The history of it is since stock-based compensation came, shareholder returns are down and volatility is up, so shareholders are taking it in the teeth. But it's fabulous for CEOs. It's just absolutely fabulous. In current dollar CEOs were making, on average, of big U.S. companies, top 400 U.S. companies were making $850,000 in 1976, and they're making $14 million now. So the tricky part is if you're the only company that doesn't give stock-based compensation, it's harder to convince CEOs to essentially do sort of charitable public service to work for you rather than just making an absolute killing working for someone else. So that's why I think there have to be some broader mechanism to make that happen.
Are there any companies that are doing it right?
Well, privately held companies are, right? I think, I mean, I think they avoid all of this insanity, because there is no operating expectations market for a privately held company. So kind of Bloomberg is an example we talked about earlier today. I think I admire what Procter & Gamble and A.G. Lafley did. A.G. Lafley, who was the CEO of Procter & Gamble from 2000 to 2009, asked the board to make his stock-based compensation vest in 10% intervals in each of the 10 years after his retirement. So in the first year after his retirement, he got one-tenth of his stock vesting. Second year, another tenth. Third, so it's going to be another 6 years until he gets his stock-based compensation. And that, you know, if you're going to have stock-based compensation, which is a fundamentally bad idea, to remind us, the farther out you make it vest after the executive in question has control over the company, the better it is. Because you don't want them playing the game of getting the stock price to crescendo right as they're leaving and leave the company in terrible situation.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. In the book, you talk a lot about encouraging people to act authentically. Mm-hmm. And I think in the world of sports, just a couple of weeks ago, we saw an example where, you know, pretty much everyone believes that these two boxers potentially didn't act authentically. Maybe the judges didn't act authentically. And boxing is an interesting example because it is a sport that has flirted with the expectations market in all sorts of ways. I mean, it's how many big fights are in Las Vegas. So I guess I wonder, this is a roundabout way of getting to the question of, you know, how do you encourage people in businesses to act authentically?
Well, I mean, I think it's an important question for business, and again, not to keep going back to the same thing. One way is get rid of stock-based compensation, mm-hmm. because stock-based compensation is an incentive to do something that I don't think is very authentic, which mm-hmm. is to focus on the expectations market rather than the real market. Right? That's why you've got CEOs hyping their stock, spending more time with Wall Street than with customers. All of those things. But it's also, the boxing thing is kind of an interesting one, which is, I think it shows, boxing is a sport that I think shows the foibles of not paying attention to governance and managing the sport carefully, right? I think my view of boxing would be we're long past the heyday when boxing was very central sport and everybody watched it and the great boxers were great heroes. I think it was a sport that was governed to not have that hanky-panky going on. I think that people have little confidence that there is a real game going on there anymore. And how important is boxing now? I'd say it's faded from glory. So this is where I think sports leagues that take governance of the sports league really seriously, I think, are going to do better over time. Similarly, if you take governance really seriously in business, I think you've got a better chance of it lasting a long time and enabling people to act authentically.
So what was it about the NFL that inspired you to use that as the model for your book rather than, you know, Major League Baseball or the NBA?
Two things. One is sort of arcane. The other is maybe more important. One is just the mammoth success of the NFL. So the NFL is by far the most successful sport in America by all measures, TV ratings, revenues, whatever measure you use. The other thing is more arcane, which is the way you bet on football is most analogous to a stock price. So the point spread and a stock price are exactly the same, whereas in other sports, it's not a point spread. It's often stated in terms of odds, and mm-hmm. so the translation is not as easy as a point spread. A point spread is a stock price, saying that who is the Kentucky Derby and Preakness winner. I'll Have Another, saying I'll Have Another as a 5-4 favorite to win the Belmont before he went out, is not exactly analogous to a stock price in a different structure. So that's the other reason.
Okay.
Plus, I love the NFL.
That helps. So I'd like to turn the conversation to your role as kind of the design MBA writer.
Right.
I know we have a lot of designers in the house.
Yep.
And I'm curious to know, you know, from our perspective, we're always trying to gain traction in the world of business, you know, from the perspective of design. And you talk a lot about customer delight as being something that should be a motivator within a business. So my question is, how can designers, you know, from your perspective as a business person, what do designers need to do to gain more traction in your world?
I think if there's one piece of advice I could give to designers in terms of working more productively and creating more value for business is to think about the challenge of working with business as legitimate a design challenge as designing the things that they design, right? So you've got product designers who design things, and you've got graphic designers who design logos, and user interaction designers who design user interfaces. And what I find in talking to designers in each of those is if you give a user interface designer a really tough user interface challenge, like really tough, you got to do it fast, and you got to do it perfect and everything, and they say, oh man, that's cool, I'll take that on, and I'll work day and night to do that because I love a hard design challenge. And then if you sell the same designer and you're going to actually have to work for a fairly miserable CEO who doesn't think much of design and is really nervous and worried about it, about design, they're more inclined to say, ooh, I don't like that. I'm going to go work for somebody who's more friendly to design and doesn't have this bad attitude. And so I ask myself the question, so, like, are you a designer or not? Don't you like hard design challenges? And here, the hard design challenge happens to be designing a way of interacting with that client to create the possibility for a fabulous result. And you're telling me that's like illegitimate and the actual user interface design is legitimate. Why? What I think is, as long as designers bifurcate between those two and don't see the challenge of designing in a unfriendly design environment as big a design challenge and as important a design challenge as designing the thing, they're going to be stuck. They're going to be stuck about where they are, which is not solving a very big piece of the business challenge. Right? So a very big piece of the business challenge for the CEO or whoever the business person wanting the design is, I have to figure out how to do something innovative and new. I have to.
Sorry, they sent me to the wrong room.
Yeah, great. With your phone, I have to design something new and innovative in a world where I've got people saying to me, you have to produce reliable results, right? Well, that's sort of hard, right? Mm-hmm. That's a challenge for that business person. And so I think empathizing with that business person and saying, okay, that's his or her box that they're in, and I'm going to design a way of working with that person that helps them kind of overcome that challenge or box they're in. If that was taken as seriously as designing the object or the interface or the logo, then CEOs would be more likely to say, I love those people. I love those people. They empathize with me, they understand me, and they figure out how to work with me. Instead of CEOs saying, those designers are not very friendly to me, and I don't know how to communicate with them.
So let me ask a question about kind of how to have that you know, how to put on that right hat to have that conversation. I think, you know, a lot of times, whether you're an in-house designer or whether you're coming in as a consultant, you're generally solving problems and looking out pretty far into the future, similar to what groups like McKinsey or Bain may be doing with the CEO in a different way, kind of having a different conversation about that. So I guess I wonder, are there things that you know, you've founded a consultancy like Bain and McKinsey called the Monitor Group. Mm-hmm. So I guess my question to you is, do you have any advice for designers who are seeking to up-level their conversation, you know, any kind of specific secret words or ways of speaking that we should know about?
Sure. And it, I could reference the book that you talked about before. So I wrote this book called The Design of Business, and one of the things that I pointed out in there is that there are these two worlds, the world of reliability, the production of a consistent, replicable outcome, and the world of validity, producing an outcome that we'd really want to have. And the two of them are in conflict or tension with one another. And what generally happens with businesses, especially large businesses, is that they have to be very concerned with reliability, producing a consistent, replicable outcome, meaning payroll for hundreds of thousands of people, delivering quarterly earnings, and the like. So lots of business executives live more in the world of reliability than in the world of validity. Designers, generally speaking, wouldn't be designers. They would have picked some other career if they weren't more in the world of validity. They say, I want to produce something that's wonderful. I want to produce the best logo, the best user interface, new, different, you know, if necessary, in order to be absolutely the best. In fact, if it's new and different, it's probably better. All of those things are manifestations of a desire to have validity, a great answer. So what designers tend to speak is in the language of validity. They wouldn't realize it, and they wouldn't realize how foreign it is, but I would argue that it is like Greek to most CEOs when they come in and say, when a designer says, oh, we can do something that's fantastic, totally out of the box, never been done before, etc. The designer thinks the CEO will say, great, because that would be all validity-oriented speak. And the CEO instead is saying, holy smokes, this is going to be trouble. I'm worried. I'm nervous. And so in speaking to business people, what I'd say to designers, you got to size up the degree to which they are focused on reliability. Now, they wouldn't be talking to you at all if all they cared about is producing a consistent, replicable, if crappy outcome. So they probably have an aspiration for more. That's why they're talking to you. But if you hit them with a barrage of validity-oriented stuff that gives no signal that you care about their reliability challenges, then they're not going to like you as much and trust you as much. So what I'd say is learn the language of reliability. And that's doing things like the understanding what best demonstrated practices and consistency and a bunch of those words and throwing those into the conversation every once in a while. They'll understand that you at least appreciate their context. It's called deep user understanding.
Right.
Which, well, I'd want to do on a client, not just the other kinds of users.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting because I think, you know, businesses need to balance their operational efficiency, as you say in your book, with the breakthrough ideas. And I think it's interesting in sports, just to bring it back to sports for a second, teams often have to bottom out, right, before they can go in a breakthrough direction. You need to kind of lose a lot before you fire the general manager and decide to bring in Billy Bean, who's going to kind of reinvent the way that players are evaluated.
Yep.
Is there a way in business to do both, to be operationally efficient and to encourage breakthrough ideas?
I think there is, but I think the only way it'll happen is if there's an appreciation in the organization in question that there are these two things, reliability and validity, and they are different. They're fundamentally different, and intention. If you understand all of that, then I think you've got a fighting chance. If that's obscure to you, and you're actually a CEO and you're doing all sorts of things that are promoting reliability, yet you claim you want validity, you want creativity, new ideas, and the like, then you'll be more likely to accidentally kill them. Hmm. Right? And so, as I say in the book, I say there are two words that you can utter in an organization that kill innovation. And they're very short little words said in a particular sequence. They're prove and it. You use it in that order, you will just kill innovation. Right? So if you're a CEO and you say, I want lots of innovation, and you come into my office and say, gee, Roger, we have this great idea. Fantastic idea. I think it's going to be just a big success. Here's why, blah, 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 blah. And I say, hey, but Doug, like, can you prove it? Can you prove it will be successful? Right? And I think, as a CEO, that's a very legitimate question. My board would want me to make sure it's proven. We don't try and go off and do some cockamamie, crazy-ass new thing. Prove it. But I've just killed it. Because, as it turns out, in the history of humanity, no new idea has ever been proven in advance using methods that would be considered to be proof-worthy, i.e. deductive or inductive logic, a great, wacky, very wacky American pragmatist philosopher named Charles Sanders Peirce made that observation at the start of the 20th century. So that is inadvertently destroying innovation, and that's because the person who is saying that does not understand this tension and the consequences of saying something like that. So I think if you understand the tension, you can be more likely for me to say, okay, even though you're making me nervous, Doug, because I know you can't prove it, because it is a new idea, actually, we need more new ideas to actually get our sales growth going, and so I'm going to say, no, you can't have $500 million, but I'll give you $100 million to try this for a year in the Southwest region, and we'll see whether it works. And if it does, then you'll get your additional $400 million, and we'll blow it out across the
deal.
Country. Yeah, so there you go. See? See, it can be all happiness, sweetness, and life if we just understand
so
one another.
In the opposable mind, you you use the example of the Four Seasons, and the founder of the Four Seasons kind of redefining luxury not as an architectural thing or as some kind of physical thing, but as a service thing. And that's an example of someone kind of starting from scratch and kind of imagining something that wasn't there and creating it. I guess I wonder, have you seen examples of that kind of thing being done in big monolithic corporations that are, you know, are kind of beholden to shareholders and all of the complicated positions that they're in? Are there good examples of that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think Herman Miller was a public company when they created the Aeron chair, and you know that's you know as everybody in design probably knows, it was famously mixed reviews from the market research, and they said, "The heck with this! That we're going to do it anyway," and it was a huge success. We have Procter & Gamble creating the Swiffer and making a billion-dollar-plus brand out of something that didn't exist before, that was oriented towards solving an unspoken need. And, you know, Apple has repeatedly done it as a public company. What I guess I think you just have to do as a public company is you just can't kind of suck up to the stock market and do this. Like, I think one of the reasons why Apple has been so successful is the late Steve Jobs attitude towards shareholders, right? He treated them with nothing but disdain. And he was extremely public about it.
And they loved it.
Right. Well, but partially it didn't create, I mean, it created an environment where he didn't, it was so crystal clear, right, that he wasn't going to pay attention to them, that they didn't then sort of create an expectation in their own minds that they would have attention paid to them, so that he didn't pay attention to them, they'd be terribly disappointed, right? The expectations were set. I don't care about you people. Get out of my face. I'm trying to invent the future. I'm going to bend the future. And so I think that's an important quality. I mean, I actually think that going to Wall Street and hyping your stock, saying as a CEO, well, we had a fantastic quarter, and we think the shareholder should be really happy about the fantastic quarter we've had, and we think, you know, the stock price should go up because we're doing so great. I mean, I really think it's the moral equivalent to going to the mafia and asking for a favor. They own you thereafter. You're done. They own you. And that's what CEOs do. I mean, like, think about it, right? If you go and hype your stock, right, you say, gee, we think our stock should be worth more. Be careful what you wish for. You may get it, right? Your stock goes way up. What then happens? Right? If you've succeeded marvelously, it goes up to being worth more than it really is, right? Then what happens? Nothing, yeah, goes down. Nothing you can do can defend that high water mark that you've just established, and they're on your back forever. And so I think just getting off that idea and truly not caring about your stock price. But what do? We say your incentives are all based on getting that stock price up, and so the problem with a CEO who acts like Steve Jobs is actually he was being insubordinate. Hmm. Right? He wasn't doing what his board wanted him to do when he sort of says to the share, you know, when he asked, what's the thing that worries you most about shareholders? He said it's shareholder meetings, right? That's being insubordinate. And so what we have to do is depend on CEOs to be insubordinate.
So let's pretend that we're in Palo Alto right now, and I'm Mark Zuckerberg, and these people aren't here. Mm-hmm. What would you tell him now that he's, you know, his company's worth $100 billion and expectations are sky high? Where does he go from here?
I mean, it's really hard to say, and unless it's popped all the way back, I don't think it is worth $100 billion. It went down to, is it still at 70 or 80? Billion dollars. So he's already now got a massive number of disappointed shareholders and lawsuits about it. I guess I would be saying to him, so how much fun was that? It may have seemed it at the time, right, when the investment banks were all in saying, well, Mark, I think you can get, you know, I think you can get this price. For it, you know, if we give these rosy kind of things, we can get it up to this, so your IPO level will be that. And he should have been saying to himself, every dollar higher that they suggest creates a problem for me, which is I have to meet those expectations or I go into the kind of the disappointing stock category. And I think it's a huge shift. So the big Silicon Valley thing is also, you know, Silicon Valley sort of like, you know, we're into stock-based compensation, that's everything, it's all about stock-based compensation, blah, 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 blah. They don't distinguish, in my humble estimation, they don't distinguish between pre-IPO and post-IPO stock, right? So if you're trying to recruit somebody to Facebook pre-IPO, right, and you give them stock options, what do they think? died and gone to heaven, right? If you give them, if you go public at a $100 billion valuation and you give them stock options, what do they think about those stock options? Worthless. Probably underwater soon, right? So Silicon Valley, I think, in general, conflates two things. They say pre-IPO stock is this great tool for when the company doesn't have much cash, right? It can attract people at low operating cost levels because it's giving them all this stock-based compensation. And the people on the receiving end of those stock-based compensation are willing to play that lottery, right? Which is, if this goes public, I will get a 10x or something return, a one-time 10x return. So all of that works. But when does it stop working entirely? The day they go public. And if they would just get that into their heads, I think they'd be less enthusiastic about stock-based compensation generally and be a little more careful about thinking about what kind and timing of stock-based compensation does really make Silicon Valley go. And it is not stock-based compensation post-IPO.
So if you, taking a different example, if you were giving advice to someone who was, you know, going out to start a company right now, and they were kind of trying to think about the long term of where they take that company, what kinds of advice would you give them?
If you can convince yourself, if you really want to build an institution that has lasting presence, try to stay private forever, and if you can't do forever, for as long as you possibly can. I think being a public company these days is damaging, severely damaging to your chances of long-term survival and prosperity.
Does that include not taking money from big institutions like Goldman Sachs and things like that that Facebook did before they had their IPO?
Yeah, that was their IPO. In my view, that set the course so that they couldn't not do an IPO, because I'm sure all of those shareholders who came in at that $1.5 billion a private placement, all were doing it on the basis of that was a precursor to a public offering. I mean, I just think the best businesses are businesses that don't need external capital, right? That can generate the profitability to create growth without external equity capital. Debt financing, sure, for certain things, absolutely. But I mean, it's all right. I mean, if you just think about it, right? What happens when you go public? Right, you get paid for N number of years of work up front, where N can be a large number, like in the case of Facebook, 100. We'll pay you for a century worth of work now. And by the way, we're going to not assume that has any negative effect on incentives, right? Right. Just think about yourself. So, sir, I'm going to pay you now to work for the next 100 years. Right now, you get it all. Every last cent right now. And I assume that you're going to work as hard as you'd have worked if I didn't say, I'm going to pay you for 100 years now. Now, maybe you're a wickedly hardworking fellow, but I don't think that works for many people. Well, that's what we do every time we pay people this multiple of earnings. Like the price-earnings ratio is equivalent to, you know, how many years are we paying you up front for the work you're going to do. Now, of course, if you double your earnings and whatever, that doesn't become 100 years. It's only like, you know, maybe we're going to pay you for 20 years up front. But if I told you 20 years of payment rather than 100 years, how much difference would that make to how hard you're going to work? You know, not very. It's funny how, you know, most employment contracts aren't written that way. It's like, you're going to come in and work for our company? That's great. Here's 20 years of salary. What? Who does that? I don't think anybody does. I'd take the job.
Yeah, sign me up.
Okay, well, I'd like to remind our audience listening at home that this is the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight is Fixing the Game, What Capitalism Can Learn from Sports, and by extension tonight, I think by design as well. Our program tonight is Roger Martin, who is dean of the Rotman Management School at the University of Toronto, author, columnist, consultant to CEOs all over the world, and Doug LeMoyne, who is managing director at Cooper, which is an interaction design firm that's all over the world, based here in San Francisco. So when we were putting this program together, one of the reasons that we asked Doug to talk with Roger about his book is that Doug has written and spoken quite a bit about sports in relation to design teams and how you manage design teams. And we had a great conversation, the three of us, in a conference call a few weeks ago getting ready for this. And Doug, can you tell us a little bit about that? And then, Roger, could you comment on Doug's whole approach and how you see that from your point of view?
Yeah, so I think I grew up playing sports, and I think about sports and coaching that I received a lot when I work with my design teams. And I think it's always surprised me that there isn't more of a connection between, the ways that high-performing athletes are coached by their coaches to the business world, where high-performing designers, in our case, are coached by by people like myself. It kind of surprises me sometimes that I have the responsibility to do it, which is why I look externally for other people to give me advice on it. So I think we had a South by Southwest program where we talked about team building and what we can learn from professional sports in terms of building effective teams, of thinking about roles on a team like you would positions on a particular baseball team, for example, or basketball team, and then thinking about things in discrete ways like that, and assigning tasks and expecting outcomes in the same way that you do on a sports team. So I think we kind of applied that, I've applied that in the work that I do in formal and kind of informal ways. And so it was kind of fascinating to talk to Roger, because he also has kind of a sports background and brought some of his sports competitiveness into the work that he's done.
No, I think that all makes lots of sense to me. And I guess I've always believed, like I think you do, based on your writing, that's one of the reasons why sports are so popular, is they are little mini metaphors for life, right? It's just like Shakespearean plays were designed to be little metaphors for kind of classical situations and dilemmas in life. And guess what? Theater is really, really popular. Well, and so is sports for that reason. It sort of distills down life into some kind of lessons. You have to be a team, and you, all the things you're talking about. And so I think looking to sports, because people learn wonderfully through metaphors, looking to sports for metaphors, I think is a useful thing, because I think sports parallels life and makes for typically cleaner, simpler kind of metaphors. The rules of every sport they're simpler than the rules of life, mm-hmm. right? They're more straightforward than the rules of life, but they kind of mirror life. So you watch kind of life happening, a team doing well and then doing badly for a while. Well, that's like somebody, whatever, losing their investments and going bankrupt and then having to build back up. Mm-hmm. And it's exciting to watch, and you root for them as you're building back up, and you cringe as they're going down. I think it's a useful place to look for lessons for life and friendly metaphors for life.
Okay, at this point, we're going to turn it over to our audience here at the Commonwealth Club for questions. Renee has got the microphone.
So we're in San Francisco, and the America's Cup is coming here soon. What lessons for business can you take from sailing as a sport?
Roger.
Oh, well, it's one of my very favorite metaphors, which is tack away. I am stunned in the world of business. How many times that essentially a business boat that is two or whatever three boat lengths behind simply keeps tacking exactly behind the boat, hoping somehow miraculously that it'll end up ahead of it when it almost never does, because if the boat ahead is being clever and covering well, it's never going to let them out. But they won't tack away and say we're going to have to tack away. So that would be the metaphor. Recognize that there are times when you simply have to tack away because it isn't going to end well, especially like if you're match racing, right? You're going to have raced for 4 hours or something, and you knew you're going to lose after you crossed the start line behind if you continue to tack with them.
So,
hello,
my name is Alan Cooper. I confess I have your book on my shelf. It sits there unread, laughing at me, and so maybe the answer to my question's in it. But my
Could
question
be.
Is, how do you bell the cat? How do you get the expectations game out of the reality game in business?
Well, a couple things. So I don't think you can have a life devoid of expectations and both the downsides and the upsides of expectations, right? So I would say to anybody who's a pet owner, if you feed your dog at 6 a.m. for one straight week, that dog will be pawing at your bedroom door for the rest of all time at 6 o'clock unless you feed it. That's building and creating expectations that you then have to live with. So you can't take expectations completely out of life, and there's some things that are good about expectations. Four Seasons has something that's really good about expectations. People expect to be treated a certain way when they get to a Four Seasons, which is why in advance of getting there, they're willing to pay $1,000 a night for their room. And if they didn't have those expectations, they wouldn't pay that insane amount of money, which isn't insane because it's actually kind of worth it. So what I argue in the book is that we just have to try and avoid the worst extremes of expectations. And for me, the worst extremes of expectations are having the quarterback paid most to beat the point spread rather than to beat the opposition. And I think if you got rid of that, and you still had the stock market, right? And so the expectations of a company would be there in spades. You just wouldn't have this sort of kind of afterburner on the problems, and that would do enough cat belling, I think, to make the world quite a different place.
Hi, I really enjoyed the talk and your book, and I have many questions for you. But let me just raise two ways in which I struggle with the analogy that you're drawing, and I'd be interested in your reaction.
Sure.
One is the analogy between sports gamblers and the shareholders and executives. The gamblers, right, they make naked bets. It seems to me to be much more akin to the derivatives market and hedge funds, whereas executives, regular shareholders, yes, they're making a bet to some extent, but don't they also have an underlying interest in the business value? I guess that, to me, that kind of difficulty with the analogy suggests to me a condemnation of the derivatives and hedge fund market, but suggests much less of a problem with executive stock compensation. The other analogy that you draw is between the NFL's focus
Can I just answer that? Because I always get into the forgetting mode. So if no, don't apologize. I'm apologizing. May I just answer that one so I don't forget, and then you can ask me the next one? I think You're absolutely right in degree. So I do think the more, if you will, leverage you put on the bet, the greater, if I think it has a negative effect, the greater the negative effect it will have. But I guess I would disagree that the analogy is sort of imperfect when you take some of the leverage out of the bet, right? I think For me, the great problem that remains is a problem of attempting to do what your incentives have instructed you to do. So what I would say is that if I say to you, you're the CEO of my company, I'm the chairman of the board, and I say you will get DSUs, you have $5 million worth of DSUs at the start of every calendar year. I think, and that's your incentive compensation, to do well. I think you're insubordinate if you don't work first and foremost on raising expectations about future performance. So even though it's not a naked bet, I think it is insubordinate for you not to follow that, and I think that then has the effect of turning you more towards the expectations market than the real market. Now you could say yes, but my other $5 million, if you get $10 million compensation face value, kind of the other $5 million. Is real market compensation, and especially if it says, well, you get that $5 million if you meet these kind of return on net assets totals or whatever. So it's not as leveraged on the expectations market, but it's still pretty large.
I'll save my other comment so that other people can speak.
Thanks. I'll answer the question later.
My question to you is, in the situation, let's say everything goes according to your plan, and you have some company, and you decide to completely decouple it from the expectation market, what would, besides what you brought up about being able to attract talent to the CEO position, what would be the potential downsides of completely just disregarding the expectation market in today's economy for a company?
Well, actually, I mean, I maybe I'm naive, but I don't see any other downside. Right, so I think companies that, because shareholder value maximization, as much as people say, oh wow, we want to maximize value for the shareholders, it's sort of all well and good to say, but you can't do it, right? You can't directly do it. So if you can't directly do it, why give an incentive for it? Give an incentive for the thing you can directly do, which is to make real market, like real managers can make real market performance do better if they work hard at it. And if real market performance does do better over the long haul, shareholders will do better. I mean, that's what I write about. I write about Johnson & Johnson, right? In 1948, they go public, and Robert Wood Johnson creates the credo that's engraved in granite that says, customers come first, employees come second, the communities in which we work come third, and last, and they don't use the term next, they say, and last come the shareholders. But he said, but if we do the first three, they'll do just fine. Well, you know, Johnson & Johnson has for a long time been one of the top 20 market cap companies in the world, so it grew from nothing in 1948 to one of the top 20 by doing what? Saying to the shareholders, like, that's you could argue, like, Jobs was bad on this front, like, thumbing his nose at them. But this is sort of like, you know, this is a caste system, and you're permanently the fourth caste in this system. It's being so direct, so in some sense negative, but the result is positive. And so I don't see other downside. This is a perverse system that it is not natural. It came into being a mere 32 years ago. It's not natural, useful, or anything. It's the modern equivalent of saying, we need pipes to carry our water. Let's make them out of lead, right? Let's be Roman. Let's make them out of lead. It's just a bad idea.
You have bubbles and crashes in the title of your book, which I haven't read yet. What do you have to say about that subject?
Well, what I say about the subject is it took us 71 years between the third last crash that was enough of a crash, right? That it created a kind of major economic downturn, Right? And then we've only had 7 years between the second last and the last. And the last one was worse than the second last one, and we're still dealing with it. We're not out of it yet. So what do I say about that? I say, well, that's interesting, greater frequency and even kind of increasing depth. I think we will have another economic crash within 7 years or less of the last economic stock market crash, I should say, within 7 years or less of the last one, because we have done nothing, zero, nada, to do anything that would reduce the likelihood of a crash. It reminds me, I have an academic mentor who I love dearly, Chris Argyris, who is the sort of the one of the fathers of writing about organizational learning or lack thereof. And after the Challenger crash, you recall there was the Rogers Commission. The Rogers Commission was this long involved commission that came up with all sorts of things that NASA needed to do to take into account all what they'd learned from the Challenger crash. And Chris wrote an unpopular article in which he asserted that he believed that if NASA implements everything in the Rogers Commission, that he's absolutely certain beyond a shadow of a doubt that there will never be another space shuttle crash caused by a takeoff in cold weather that causes the O-wing to crack and fuel to spew out and blow up the space shuttle. But no other reason why a space shuttle might crash was diminished by one iota. He was widely held in scorn for that until, of course, when a piece of foam fell off the cooling tank that hit the bottom of the wing that caused the space shuttle to blow up, and after which they sort of said, maybe he had a point there. That's my view of the fixes. The fixes, we put in place a bunch of fixes, right? After the 2001 meltdown, what did we have? Sarbanes-Oxley, FASB 142, all sorts of things. We're going to fix it so this never happened again. Well, it happened in 7 years. It's because we're not pointing at the cause, and there's nothing that we've done, that will help prevent the next crash.
I was curious about the earlier conversation regarding designers trying to persuade executives or CEOs, in your case, of the validity of their profession. Unfortunately, I find myself in that position quite a bit. And I have my own tactics. Sometimes I say, if you hire someone like me, you're delaying gratification, but the end result will be a lot better because they see my profession as additional cost and time to their project. Sometimes I also sort of point to bellwether companies, I mean, a host of them, from Nike, Apple, et cetera, that say, hey, look, these guys do it, and they're successful, therefore, you know, draw from their example. I'm just wondering, you know, what type of tactical advice do you have for someone who's trying to persuade that CEO? A lot of times it sort of seems like the men are from Mars and the women are from Venus, or we're talking completely different types of people. And how do we sort of get them to see that, you know, design is a really valuable technique and perspective to bring to the business process?
So, as a designer, I'm assuming that you probably, when you're trying to design something, you do very deep user understanding and really get inside the user's head and watch them carefully so that you really empathize with their challenges and their problems.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do that with the CEO and your world will change completely.
Well, excuse me. Unfortunately, we've reached a point in our program where we have time for only one more question, and that is the man on the back with the microphone that's eagerly waiting. I would like to let our audience listening at home know that this is the Commonwealth Club of California, our program tonight, Fixing the Game, What Capitalism Can Learn from Sports, with Roger Martin, Dean of the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto, and Doug Lemoyne, Managing Director at Cooper. So I would like to ask the last question, then we'll have closing remarks.
You stated that the privately held companies are not engaged in this insanity, to use your word. And isn't a fiduciary supposed to act for somebody else's resources like he would act for his own? And therefore, aren't the directors of all the public companies breaching their fiduciary duty?
Well, I guess it depends on your definition, right? So what I think is we now have a doctrine, right, that is what's considered good management practice. So do you think the engineers in Rome were breaching their fiduciary duty to put lead pipes in, lead water pipes in? I would say that's not the way I'd describe it. I'd describe it as they were doing what seemed to be the best thing available at the time. And so boards of directors are currently doing what the theory, the prevailing theory, tells them is the best thing to do. And in fact, their biggest customers, if you really want to look at it this way, the biggest customers of boards are pension funds, right? Because they own the biggest chunk of stocks. And the pension funds regularly, thanks to advice from places like ISS, Institutional Shareholder Services, vote their proxies for companies that give their executives lots of incentive compensation that encourages better performance. So I would say they're doing what they think is right and their customers think is right. And I think the engineers that were in Roman times putting in lead water pipes were also doing what they thought was right, and they were poisoning the population of Rome. But they didn't know it, and they weren't trying to, and they thought they were doing the right thing. So I wouldn't call it breaching of fiduciary duty. I would say that they're unfortunately held in the sway of a crummy model that has to go away. My hope is that this is the very, very start of the end of that model, with somebody calling it out and saying, here's why it's just a dumb idea. That's my hope. That's why I write books like this.
Great. Well, I'd like to wrap up our program tonight and ask each of you guys very best sports metaphor applied to business and design. And Doug, I'd like to ask you first,
oh,
and then we'll end with Roger.
Kevin, you should have given me some heads up on this. But best sports metaphor for design
or
and business.
Or just best sports metaphor ever.
Best sports metaphor ever. Gosh, you know, I don't really have an internal ranking of sports metaphors. But I do. I guess I do think that I do see so many parallels between successful sports teams and successful design teams, just in the way that they function interpersonally as people. I think, like, when you're on a winning design team, you like each other, you're doing good work, like, the work is better. And I think it's really similar when you look at, for instance, the 2010 Giants. Like, you know, there are a bunch of guys who liked each other. I had to bring them up. I'm sorry. They liked each other. They vastly outperformed their past statistics and won the World Series. And I think in design it's really similar.
Yeah, I have a sort of partial answer to your question too. But for me, my favorite lesson from sports for business is my favorite baseball manager of all time, which is Earl Weaver. For any of you longtime baseball fans, he was the manager of the Baltimore Orioles in their heyday, the late 60s and up through the 70s, but it was the late 60s and early to mid 70s. And I just liked him because he was a manager who was highly, highly flexible in his use of players so as to get the best out of all of them. And so he's really the father of platooning. And he took one largely washed-up, power-hitting left fielder, John Lowenstein, and another young but kind of far too free-swinging left fielder, Gary Renicky, and together they hit 48 home runs and drove in 140 runs batted in, because he only played them against the pitchers they could hit. And he did the same with Rich Coggins and Al Bumbry in center field, and yeah. Benny Ayala was his superstar. He had the highest home runs at a bat by far of anybody in the league, but only had about 108 at-bats, I think. He hit like 19 home runs on 108 at-bats because Earl Weaver had figured out that these are the 18 pitchers that Benny could actually hit. And he sat down all the other times and went up and hit home runs the times they were up. So I think to too great an extent, the business world has a philosophy which is they have jobs that they hire people for instead of saying there are people that they should create jobs for. Earl Weaver said, there are people I can get, and I can get them really cheap, which kind of matters, you know, in that sport, because Baltimore wasn't a rich team at that time. There are people I can get, and they're not all that expensive, and I have to create jobs for them. And I wish the business world were that way, and people would be a lot happier, because a lot of people in the world of business feel like they're a square peg that is rammed every day into a round hole.
Earl Weaver also said, it's what you learn after you know it all that counts.
Oh, that is a good one. That is very good. I'll buy that, too.
Well, beautiful. I think that's a beautiful way to end our program tonight. And our program tonight has been Fixing the Game, what Capitalism Can Learn from Sports. Our program tonight was Doug LeMoyne from Cooper and Roger. I'm sorry, my mind just went blank. And Roger Martin, Dean of the Rotman Management School at University of Toronto, author of Fixing the Game. We do have Roger's book for sale out in front, and I'm sure he and Doug both would be happy to autograph it for you and give you some tips on the betting pools for this year. And so with that, I would like to thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club and our audience listening at home. This is the Commonwealth Club of California celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion. And with that, this program is adjourned.
Thank you. That's fun.